Well, I've never preached on the book of Esther before. I never really expected to, and I probably will never again in my role as a rector. You're laughing at that, but it's not that way at all. It's just I'm quite enjoying it. It's hard work, tell you the truth, preparing, and it lives with me a bit. It's a bit like doing the book of Revelation. It lived with me for months and months when I preached on it or wrote a Bible study on it once upon a time. And Esther's a bit like that because there's so much going on in this period. So we're going to do this series. I said it was 10 chapters over 6 weeks, which means the readings are long. And Terrell's got that job today. And it fell to somebody who wasn't expecting to get it this morning, but he did quite well. One of the reasons why churches don't normally preach on this big book is because God isn't mentioned in the book. Not even his name is not mentioned once. Main commentary I'll be using is written by a lady. Both my commentaries are by women, as it happens. But this one was written in 1999, though there's a new updated version come out, by a lady called Karen Jobes. And her commentary is still one of the main commentaries recommended I often go to the Gospel Coalition to see who they recommend. And if you're going to buy a commentary, it's worthwhile going there to see who they recommend. And then, if you can, having a look at it before you buy it. But the Gospel Coalition pretty well has a free commentary on every book of the Bible. So if you're preparing messages, Bible studies, or just wanting to know a bit more, it's a good place to go to. Karen herself said that you should never try preaching through the whole book of Esther. She said, just do one-offs. And the examples she sort of gave were just really one verses often. But I haven't taken her advice. In fact, whilst I say I'd had reservations about preaching through the whole of Esther, I think we'll end up getting a lot out of this book. And the reason why I say that is because I think we find ourselves today in a world that has a lot of similarities to the world in which Esther lived. A world where God was clearly at work, even though God did not always appear to be in control of what was happening. That's what we see today. And if you read the front of the news sheet, and I don't do that now, but that's sort of what I'm saying. What we see in Esther is how God was at work, but behind the scenes, bringing about his will for his people, the Jews, but in such a way that that was bringing about his will for us and for his will, for his world, because he was ensuring that his promises would be fulfilled. So I've briefly introduced the book of Esther. Let me try to put Esther into her historical context. Genesis chapter 11 is about the Tower of Babel. And at the Tower of Babel, we see humanity as a whole speaking one language, trying to make a name for themselves to compete with God, really. And God comes down in judgment. So they're building as high as they can, and God's still got to come down to have a look, really. And what he did as a result, because humanity was using their combined unity to dishonor him and disobey him, really, to not fill the earth. He came and confused their languages. And so tribes came as a result of that. And anyone who's lived amongst or worked amongst tribal peoples will know that tribes tend to be tribes who remain one group, who don't necessarily associate with other groups. And so unity between tribes is almost impossible, certainly in Australia. So at Babylon, the unity that humanity held in common, that wasn't so confused by tribes, was lost and seemingly lost forever. But then in the following chapter, to chapter 11, chapter 12, God signaled that this unity between tribes would one day be re-established. For God spoke to Abraham. And he chose Abraham, saying, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. you will be a blessing. So where God has just carried out his judgment, next chapter, God says, but you're going to be a blessing. He says, I'll bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples, so all tribes, everyone, will be blessed through you, Abraham. So here we see God, after carrying out his judgment on humanity, stepping into human events as he chooses Abraham and his descendants so that the unity that had been lost at Babel would at least to some extent be restored. For God chose to bless Abraham so that people from every nation, tribe, and language, including Aussies, could be blessed and could be reunited. And this promise was ultimately that a new nation would be formed, one tribe, made up of people from every nation, tribe, and language on earth. And of course, this promise to Abraham was fulfilled some 2,000 years later through Jesus. For as Jesus himself said, when I am lifted up, so on the cross, I will draw all people to myself. And so that's the event where that history of Babel was reversed. Most of us here already know the checkered history, checkered story of Abraham and his descendants. Who did their homework? No one. I thought Jennifer would. Is Jennifer? Yeah, Jennifer. You didn't get there? But if you really want to do your homework, you really got to start at Genesis and go through the end of 2 Chronicles. But anyway, we won't do that. So we're doing that now, and that's why I make no apologies. So where's the story of Abraham begin? Well, Dave, if you can push us forward, then I can take over. So you see Abraham in the blue dress with the white belt. So the story of Abraham begins where? Which is just down the road from Babylon. So this is from where the people were filling the earth, were scattering. And his father was taking them to Canaan, but they got a bit distracted and stopped on the way. So Abraham and his family were part of the people that left that region to find their own land for their own tribe, their own language. And God ended up leading Abraham to the land of Canaan. I think it's number 3 on the map. The land that there God promised to give to Abraham and to his descendants. But not yet, God said, I think it's Genesis 15, 400 years or something, your people will be in Egypt. And so we know that Abraham's descendants ended up in Egypt, where in time they became slaves and grieved greatly. And so God ended up rescuing his people from Egypt because they were his people. And he brought them to the promised land, to the land of Israel, where for the next 300 years it was a bit checkered, but then comes along King David. And God made a promise to King David to bring blessing to all peoples, sort of a repeat of Genesis 12, to all nations, tribes, and tongues, through a descendant, one of David's descendants, who would reign on the throne forever. But from David on, and even during David's reign, everything went downhill. For God's people, the people of Israel, continually turned their backs on God. And so after King Solomon died, the kingdom of Israel split into two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. That's why it gets a bit confusing, because there's so many different Israels that we speak of. So the kingdom of Israel, the kingdom of Judah. But eventually the people in Israel sinned so badly that God had had enough of them. And so in the 8th century BC, even though he warned them, he sent the Assyrians in to conquer his people and to scatter them. And you can see that in the purple arrows on that map. Now, let me recommend that you bring maybe binoculars with you each week to help you see some of those things. But that's the purple. They got scattered, and they basically weren't seen, heard from again. They're scattered throughout the world even today, though some have returned to the land of Israel now. But most of the tribes, 10 of the tribes. And yet, despite the people of Judah seeing their brothers and sisters in Israel being taken away because of God's judgment, the people in the kingdom of Judah didn't heed God's warnings to them. And so beginning a bit over 100 years later, 604 BC, this is the green arrows on the map, ending in 586 BC, God sent the Babylonians, King Nebuchadnezzar, and his armies to conquer the people of Judah, to destroy their cities, to destroy Jerusalem, which included destroying the temple. So the place where you came to worship God and offer your sacrifices and gain forgiveness was gone. Total ruins. And most of those who survived were taken off to where? Babylon, where the story began with Abraham. So it's like nothing had happened. They began in Babylon, they're back in Babylon. It's as if Abraham had never left. It's as if God had totally forgotten about his promises to Abraham. But then, as we know, nothing could have been further from the truth. Now, amongst those who were carried off into exile was a young man named Daniel. Heard of him? What do you know about Daniel? The lion's den. And so we get the map again. You need your binoculars, but you see a time period there where Daniel is. Interesting thing when you read Daniel, it's a very confusing book because it's talking about prophecies that God made, not very clear prophecies, about the future of that area of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, and the kingdoms that would come and fall, including the Persian and Median Empire, including the Greek Empire and Alexander the Great. And so Daniel made himself known as being a Jew, and that's significant in the book of Esther. And he, for example, interpreted King Nebuchadnezzar's dreams concerning the king's personal future. Then when Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar became king, Daniel was once again summoned. He was summoned to interpret something. Remember that hand that went on the wall that wrote something that nobody could understand? Well, Daniel was called in. And the interpretation was that Babylon, that great empire, would be conquered by the armies of the Medes and the Persians. In fact, that very night, King Belshazzar was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom of Babylon alongside of Cyrus, king of Persia. And so it became the Persian Mede Empire. There's another name for it, Achaemenid or something like that. And so we suddenly have this. So that's, it was the Babylonian Empire, and now it's the Persian Empire. And it's quite large, stretching from India through to Egypt. After that, Cyrus continued to increase in power. In some ways, God was with him. But Cyrus was different to the Babylonians. In 536 BC, so 70 years after the Jews were first taken into exile, and this was actually in fulfillment of a prophecy that God made, Cyrus allowed all the exiles to return to their lands that they'd been taken from. So whether they were Jews or from some other nation, they could return to their lands. So back to that map, it's sort of the orange one, just showing where the Jews returned back to Judah. So the Jewish exiles returned to the land. And so what they're doing, they're sort of retracing the steps of Abraham, aren't they? Starting in Babylon, close enough, heading back to Canaan, Judah. And so there's a new start being made after God sending his judgment upon them. And they began to rebuild. And they rebuilt the temple as per the purple box there. It took some time to get some traction, even though the Persian Cyrus said, well, I'll give you all the money, all the building materials to do it. You can go back. I'll keep you safe. They said, oh, not really. We don't want to. But anyway, that's another story. Though what you may not have realized is that when people could return to their land, most Jews chose to remain in Persia, in places like Babylon and Susa. And we'll look at that in more detail in the weeks to come as well. Daniel, for example, did not choose to return to Judah. Because in places like Babylon and Susa, where these people had lived for 70 years, some of them, they'd established themselves. They'd built their homes. They'd raised their children. Not many people here are from King Cumber, are they? Most people of you come from somewhere else, but for you, now this is home. You wouldn't go back, I'm from Caringbah. I wouldn't go back to Caringbah now because it's not my home now. And we understand that. And so they established themselves, built their homes, planted their fields, raised their children. You know, Judah was a bit of a mess. You look at the map of Gaza, you look at pictures of Gaza, it wouldn't have been much different to that. So whilst God 1,500 years earlier had told Abraham to go from Babylon, and he went, many of his descendants, when they were given the same opportunity to return home to the land that God gave them, chose to stay. And these Jews remained in Persia, and there's a bit of a map here, the red arrow, during the reigns of Cyrus, Bardia, Cambyses II, Darius the Persian, Xerxes the Great, and even longer than that. And though it's during the reign of Xerxes in the brown box that the story of Esther occurs. In some translations, if Richard's got his ESV today, it says Ahasuerus. That's the sort of the Greek name, same person. So let's begin looking at Esther's story. We still haven't started the Bible reading, have we? No, that's right. No, the Bible reading's the interlude. Amongst the families who chose to remain in Susa, in Persia, was the family of Mordecai, which included his cousin Esther. Susa was the place where the king of Persia would go in winter, and that was quite common. The same happened in the land of Israel when Herod had a summer palace and a winter palace. And Susa is located in modern-day Iran. So very close to Babylon, where Babylon was. Now, the reign of Xerxes began in the year 486 BC. And while you can't really see that, the top line, it's where the green boxes hit the timeline there. And there's sort of a dark yellow line. I think that's the reign of Xerxes. So the events described in the book of Esther began to take place 3 years after Xerxes became king. So now we get to the Bible reading. That's where we are in salvation history. Now we look at the events that begin to take place in the first two chapters. I said to Cheryl she can read, and if she needs me to take over, I will.
The reading today comes from Esther chapter 1, verses 1 to chapter 2, verse 18. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other, and the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink without restriction, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palaces of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Bistha, Habona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king: Karshena, Shetha, Admatha, Tarshish, Mers, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Medea who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked, for she has not obeyed the king, the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed through all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household using his native tongue. Chapter 2. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young women who pleases the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favor. Immediately, he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a young woman's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had a complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Shargaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. This is the word of the Lord.
No claps, no cheers. So what we're told by whoever wrote the book of Esther is that Xerxes the Great came to the throne after his father Darius had died. At that time, the Greeks were becoming a great military power. In fact, not long before Xerxes had died, Darius had lost a significant battle against the Greeks when Darius sought to overthrow Athens. Some of you have been to Athens. And so it's prior to the Greek Empire really reaching its peak and the Romans then conquering them. And so when Xerxes came to power, Xerxes sought to succeed against the Greeks where his father had failed. But in order to be victorious, Xerxes needed allies. His father's army had just lost. And so 3 years into his reign, Xerxes sought to garner support for a new campaign. And he did this by inviting potential allies to Susa, to his winter throne. And he opened all his doors to them so that they could see his great wealth and power. And he opened the doors to everyone, no matter who they were, for 180 days. And he did this so that all, we read, the military leaders from Persia and Media, along with their princes and their nobles, and in fact all the people, they'd see his wealth and power and then come and fight alongside him against the Greeks and possibly make their own fortunes. And at the end of those 188 days, which in what is described by historians as being the Great War Council, and in order to seal the deal, Xerxes threw a huge party, lasted 7 days, no expense was spared. Give them what they want to drink because then they'll sign up. And it was then or there that Xerxes announced his plans to punish the Athenians and to burn Athens to the ground. At the same time as Xerxes throwing his party, we read that Vashti, his queen, was holding her own party for the wives, because how do you sometimes get to the husbands? Through the wives. And it's at this point we begin to see that the book of Esther is possibly not written as an accurate or objective book of history. The only place you can really read about the history of the Persian Empire is by a fellow called Herodotus. And he was a Greek, And he was a guy who wrote after Alexander the Great had defeated the Persians. And when Alexander the Great came and conquered the Persians, he burnt all the history. There were no history books in Persia left. And this is why when we turn to history, we've got to turn to Herodotus for the Persians. And one of our problems is that the history found in the Book of Esther is not mentioned by Herodotus. For example, there is no wife named Vashti. There is no queen named Esther. Now, we can get around that a little bit because, as he does elsewhere, Herodotus doesn't always bother to mention all the names of all the wives of the kings of Persia. And so the only wife that he actually mentions is the one who gave birth to the next king, Artaxerxes, and her name was Amestris. So maybe Vashti, some people sort of ask you, say that she was one in the same as Amestris, but maybe not. Now, this, along with several other issues regarding what's contained in the Book of Esther, is why scholars are divided over whether the accounts contained in the book are historical or fictional. Most importantly for us is over whether a Jew was ever a queen of Persia in the time of Xerxes. And we'll look at this as the weeks go on. You know, once upon a time, till recently, historian scholars didn't believe that there was ever a pilot who existed. Not Pilate, like Bill, but Pilate, the governor, who ordered Jesus to be executed. Why not? There's no evidence for it in the history books or the archaeology, but then they dug up this tablet. And so we may see a day where something else is dug up in the sands of Iran, and some of the things contained in this book are seen for what they are. And until that happens, we've just got to cop that on the chin. Because if you say, well, Esther's a history book, well, you're not necessarily going to get support for that. Well, that said, let's get back to the story. And so back to this diagram, which will be the main one for the series. So King Xerxes is throwing his party for the men. Vashti's throwing her party for the women. Then Xerxes comes up with this great idea of showing off the greatest symbol of his power and wealth, namely his Queen Vashti. Why? Because she was lovely to look at. But Vashti, who had been Xerxes' partner in every sense of the world, in all his plans up till then, she does the unthinkable. Because for whatever reason, though, there are a number of reasons given, and you might think of your own, Vashti refuses to appear before her husband and the men that her husband was trying to impress. And so Xerxes gets a bit embarrassed at being disrespected and dishonored at the peak of him trying to show off everything. For here he is, the most powerful man in the world, calling on all these other great people to join him in battle. And what's his wife do? She defies him. And as a result, verse 12, Xerxes became furious and he burned with anger. And yet, you know, it's here in this seemingly insignificant event at one level that we see our sovereign Lord Yahweh enter the scene. For God had a plan for his people. We've known about that since the days of Abraham. And he had a plan for his world. And because God knew what would soon take place, God needed Vashti out of the way so that he could put his person in her place. But you've got to wait to hear the whole story to know what I mean by that. But that said, in this event of Vashti defying her husband, we actually see God present in the Book of Esther, working on behalf of his people and us, his world. For it's at this point that Xerxes gathers his experts in law and justice and asks them, verse 15, according to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? For she's not obeyed the command of King Xerxes. We read that one of the men, Memucan, advised Xerxes that not only had Queen Vashti done wrong by Xerxes, She'd done wrong by everyone, all the nobles and peoples of all the provinces over which Xerxes ruled. But Memucan advised Xerxes that Vashti had set all the wives an example of how to behave towards their husbands, so that they, like their queen, would end up defying and despising their husbands. He says in the end, verse 18, there will be no end to disrespect and discord within their homes. And because of this, Memucan advised the king to issue a decree that could not be reversed, whereby Vashti could never again enter into his presence. And also that her position as queen should be given to someone who is better than her. But then Memucan concluded all the women would respect their husbands from the poorest peasant to the greatest prince. And we read that Xerxes took his advice. He sent messengers throughout the world, including Israel, that every man should be ruler over his own household. So what happened after that? Well, we jump forward 3 or 4 years. And so I just need to fill you in on that. What had Xerxes been doing? He'd had the Great War Council. What do you do after the War Council? You go and fight a war. So he's trotted off. So Vashti's been dealt with. He trots off to Athens, threatening to blow it up and destroy it. And his navy, huge, enormous navy, gets wiped out by this little Greek navy. And he comes across 300 Spartans, and they hold him off for ages. And some of you have seen those films over the years. That one, 1962. I wasn't alive then, but I've probably seen it on a Sunday afternoon, and that's Xerxes sitting down. It's not a bad depiction of him, except for the skin colour probably should be a little bit darker. Then in 2014, and I don't recommend you watch this one, but they pictured him like this, 7-foot giant, Athens will burn. But Athens didn't burn. The 300 held him off. And he ends up going back to Susa with his tail between his legs. But before I do that, so what's he look like? That or that? More like that guy. And we'll see that in some of the pictures that come in the weeks to come. Pictures are all for you, Jennifer. There you go. And it's to help us keep focused. So he comes home defeated, though his army's still significant and fighting, but he's gone through a heap of money. It's all been a bit of a failure. And we read that he returns to Susa, chapter 2, verse 1. And what's he do? He remembers Vashti. Why does he remember Vashti? Because Vashti was always there for him. Now she's not. He's banished her from his presence. That command cannot be revoked. The most powerful man in the world cannot revoke his own word, and that becomes significant later. And so he regrets his decision, but he couldn't repeal it. In fact, from verse 2, it seemed that maybe he was feeling a bit depressed. Nothing was going his way, and the people were revolting against him. And so he'd lost in war, he'd lost his wife, didn't have that support, and he couldn't do anything about the decision he made. And so we read in verse 2, and probably in response to the mood that the king was in, that his personal attendants proposed to Xerxes that a search be made of his kingdom for beautiful virgins, and that they all be brought to Susa, where they'd be given a year to undergo beauty treatments before each of them were given the opportunity to sleep with him. And further to this, they suggested that Xerxes should then choose one of these women to be his new queen. It was during this time in his life that the Greek historian Herodotus comments that Xerxes' morality went downhill. He was idle. He'd lost in battle. Much like King Solomon's morality went downhill during his reign. So this suggestion by his attendants, we read, appealed to Xerxes. He agreed. Search was made of the kingdom for the most beautiful of the virgins so that he might sleep with all of them. Even only once. So make no mistake, this was an act of brutality. This isn't a love story going on here. Especially for those women who had no desire to be taken from their homes and their families to become part of the king's harem. It was a command. It had to happen. You may have hidden your daughter if you knew what was coming. You might have, what's the word? Disfigured her to protect her. Brutal taunts. But then it's as this is going on that for the second time we see our sovereign Lord's hand at work. For in verse 5, we read that in the citadel of Susa was a Jewish man named Mordecai from the tribe of Benjamin. We know Benjamin was the smallest of the tribes. What we read is that Mordecai had a cousin whose parents had died and that Mordecai took her on as his own daughter. And the woman's name was Hadassah. We're told that Hadassah had a lovely figure and she was very beautiful. And so, of course, when a search was made of the virgins in Susa, well, there's Hadassah. Let's take her. So whether Mordecai pushed her into this, we don't know. But then no one would have dared to disobey the king's command. So Hadassah was taken to the citadel of Susa. He was put under the care of Hegai, who had charge of the harem. And we read that Hadassah pleased Hegai. We keep seeing this phrase repeated. And she won his favour. And so Hegai gave Hadassah special treatment. He gave her an advantage, really, over the other virgins. She was probably his choice for queen. So once again, we see our sovereign Lord's hand at work in world affairs as Hadassah wins the favour of Hegai, helped by the fact that Hadassah was prepared to listen to everything that Hegai advised her to do. And it's probably a quality that we pick up on her throughout this whole book. This brings us to verse 10, where we read that Hadassah, or Esther, as she was known, had not revealed her Jewish nationality or family background. Why was that? Her adopted dad had forbidden it. Don't reveal that you're a Jew. In fact, that's why from now on I'll refer to her as Esther, for Hadassah was her Jewish name. To go by that name would have given away her secret, whereas Esther is a good Persian name. And I actually assume that Esther dressed, behaved, ate like a Persian, probably in every way. So Esther, we read, joined the harem of virgins. So there's two harems, one for the virgins, one for those who had slept with the king. And for 12 months, she had attended a beauty spa. And when her time came to leave the harem of virgins and to present herself before the king where she would have sex with him and lose her virginity, she would from that time on live in a new home amongst the king's concubines. There she'd remain as part of that harem of concubines unless the king gave the command for her to return. But if he didn't call on her, Esther would have lived there for the rest of her life amongst these women in a luxurious, lonely existence, isolated from family, isolated from everyone, with all the other women that the king had rejected. What we read in verse 16 is that in the seventh year of his reign, Esther was taken into the royal residence of King Xerxes. Xerxes was attracted to her more than any of the other women. Esther again won the king's approval, favor and approval, verse 17. And so Xerxes placed a royal crown on Esther's head, made her a Jew, queen of the great kingdom of Persia. And he held a great banquet for Esther because he was happy. There'd been so many losses, but now he's happy. Calls a public holiday, hands out gifts to the people as he embraced his new wife and his new queen. And so the scene is set. Our sovereign Lord, make no mistake, had worked behind the scenes to place a descendant of Abraham on the throne of Persia, of all places, near Babylon. For this seemingly insignificant event would lead to the descendants of Abraham being saved from extinction. So that God's promises to Abraham, where we began, and to Abraham's descendants and to the world and to us, would be fulfilled through Jesus. That's what we see going on here. But then that's where we leave Esther today. As the unexpected queen of Persia, Esther comes to the throne. And so come back next week if you're game. They do get shorter after this, I think. But hear what happens next and why Esther matters to us. I won't pray today. We'll respond with a song. Let me just look up what it is. Praise my soul, the King of Heaven. There's a lot of talk about kings and Xerxes the Great, but this